Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Hi, welcome to an edition of Speaking of Reliability. This is Adam Barrett. I'm here at RAMS 2020 with Jessica Musser, a reliability engineer. Hi, Jessica.
Hello. How's it going?
Good, good. We've had a lot of fun talking with so many people here, and we got going on a conversation, and I said, hey, that's going to be a good Speaking of Reliability podcast, so let's hit record. So what were we talking about?
We were talking about culture, especially reliability culture, whether it's in manufacturing or even in the workplace. So my background, I'm a mechanical engineer. I got my bachelor's degree at Tennessee Tech University. That's a little bitty town in Cookeville, Tennessee. but it's in a beautiful place. It's out in the country and you can go hiking. There's waterfalls, all that fun stuff. So my degree, the environment that I was around, I was with a bunch of good old boys, all the country folk, right? Everybody worked hard. They played hard. And when I graduated, I started working in at Logan Aluminum, and they're a manufacturer of aluminum can sheet. I worked there for about 4 or 5 years just as a mechanical engineer, and I did capital improvement projects, a little bit of reliability work, just kind of like a montage of things. And one thing that I really appreciated there was the culture, whether it was to do with safety, reliability, continuous improvement,
yep,
all of those aspects, they were strongly supported from the top down. Then I left Logan Aluminum and went to work at IKO. They're a roofing manufacturer. And it was at a brand new plant in Texas. And it was like the complete opposite. But instead of having that culture, you know, already culminated there.
Yep.
I was kind of responsible for encouraging that growth myself.
Wow. That's pretty, yeah. I mean, that's both hard and that's kind of cool, right?
Yeah. And I also started there, that was my first role as a reliability engineer. So coming from an environment where everything was already set up for me, I didn't have to really do anything except follow the rules. And then transferring to a location that had nothing established.
Yeah.
And I had to I was there to develop their reliability plan.
Yeah.
And the biggest struggle for me there was the culture. It took about a year just to get people on board.
Really?
Plant management, everybody supported it. I didn't really have the support from the mechanics, from the electricians. Some of them bought into it, but not all of them. And they were used to that reactive approach. You know, if it breaks down, we go out there, we fix, we work hard. They don't write a work order.
Right.
They might fill in like, oh, I spent this much time on it. I pulled these parts out of inventory, and that's it.
Yeah.
But I couldn't do any root cause analysis.
You can't project anything.
So it was all up. The mindset there was just make sure production keeps running.
Right.
And
By reacting. Right.
So it was really difficult for me going from an environment where you had complete support to an environment where I had like kind of fake support.
Right. Yeah. Right. So do you think some of what you're calling, you know, the fake support was it that they didn't want to, it was really insincere, or they didn't know how to, they didn't know what to do to help or create an environment that would support it?
Well, I really believe that a lot of it is education, mm-hmm. education about what reliability is, and how it can actually help people. You can apply reliability in all aspects of your life, if you think about it.
Yeah.
But especially in the work environment and in manufacturing, in the U.S. itself, the mindset has been just go fix it.
Right.
Get production running. And I think that it should be on leadership to train their personnel on reliability and giving them those tools to understand why they need to be focusing on it.
Yep. we're still doing that old thing from decades ago of give it to reliability, they'll make it better. Like there's some person there that's going to wave a magic wand and make it better, right? Yeah. As an add-on, and it's not part of the core, part of the culture, yeah. You know, driven from the bottom.
And even having a good foundation as far as like what your mission, what's your vision, what your company's vision is, those are key tools to getting your culture in the place that you want it to be.
Right.
At Logan Aluminum, one of their I think it was one of their principles was treat every resource like a management resource. So it didn't matter who you were.
Yeah.
You could just be an operator and you see a problem, you can tell them to stop the production line.
That's very much like the Japanese kind of, you know, everybody has the responsibility and has the power to take their observation and do something with it.
But to be able to put that amount of trust
in your
operations teams, your technicians teams,
that takes a lot of
leadership.
Right.
You know.
Right. That's a big shift. You know, because if you go back to like the time of Henry Ford, he was quoted as saying, "Why does every pair of hands I get come with a brain?" He didn't want people to think. He didn't want people to be a part of it. He just wanted people to do what they're told. And then it was, you know, Deming who came along later. And really had the theory and then, you know, really proved it, that everybody is very observant. Everybody does care a lot. Everybody does want to do a good job. It's not just for rewards. We all instinctively want to do a good job. So why not tap into it? And even that didn't really click well until we all started reading the Toyota Way and these Kaizen methods and seeing the way the Japanese really do believe every single person really wants to do a good job and should be trusted as, you know, as that. So how do you think now, so those two cultures you were in, how do you think one came about? Because they're both, you know, it's not like one was owned by a foreign entity. They both were local, domestic. You know, how do you think they came about with those two different cultures then?
Well, the impression that I got at Logan was that since the operators and, like, from the very beginning of, and this is just the training that they gave me too, right? But they had their principles already established. That was a goal of theirs within the first 5 years, I think, of after they built the plant.
Yeah.
They developed those principles immediately. And then they, like, the number one is we're the best at what we do.
Yep.
Right? They focused on making the best product in the world.
Yep.
And they are. They are the best in the world at manufacturing aluminum can sheet.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and that's what they strive for. They continue to strive for that, but they also focus on the people that are making it.
Right, so they get what it takes to get there. Because that's one thing everybody says they want to be the best.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, because
you also have to include the people that are supporting that goal.
Right.
You know, it's not just about this big wig up at the top saying, "Hey, I want you to be the best for me."
Right, the Henry Ford.
Everybody's got to buy into it.
So, okay, so what are some of those mechanisms then that bring everybody in like that you saw? In addition to the fact, so you described that an individual person could you know act as a manager and bring attention to something, right?
Well, one of the things that they did at Logan was say had a rotation structure.
Yep.
So they would have each role, whether you were operator or mechanic, you could rotate into a different role every couple of years. So you would actually be, you could just be doing like a normal, you know, there's like a 12-hour shift or whatever. Go do your shift and just push the button to make the machine go.
Right.
Or you could actually have a role in their safety team.
Okay.
You could be the safety, you can actually be the safety lead for a couple of years, or you could be a reliability, you could help with the reliability team. There were all sorts of different options there.
Right.
And they didn't hold anybody back. If you said, "Hey, I want to learn more about the hot mill," you know, or because they had there's a lot of different machinery that they had there, a different business unit. So if you were in one unit, you wanted to go learn more about the other, it's possible that they would let you transition over to that other team.
Right. But they get how it benefits them.
Because if they have one person, if they understood how the entire plant operated, they could potentially move up to management in the future.
Right.
And especially their location is, you know, it's in the middle of nowhere, you know, in Kentucky.
Right. So recruiting is a whole other thing.
Recruiting is very difficult for them. So they want to keep the people that they have.
Right.
And they want them to be skilled and have those abilities that they need for future management and understand what the next person coming in is going to have to deal with.
So you believe that it really was just, that was one of the cornerstones they built on from the beginning?
Yes, and they truly believe in educating their employees.
Right.
And they're constantly learning.
Yeah.
It does not stop.
Yeah.
And that's in line with my own principles, my own beliefs. I believe that people as a whole, people want to learn things.
Yeah.
They want to feel empowered.
Yeah.
And if you give them that power to make a decision, like, you know, shutting down a line, if you see a problem,
right,
then they're going to want to be there.
They'll rise to the occasion too, yeah. Right? They'll really, yeah, because people do instinctively want to do a good job. You want to walk away with pride,
yeah,
right, in your work.
Have you ever read the book Drive?
No, I haven't.
So my mom, she's a huge proponent of like making me read every business book out there.
Sounds like a good mom.
I didn't read it, but I listened to it on an audio tape, yeah. And I cannot remember the author of it right now, but he basically talks about the progression of leadership and how we treat our people and how we guide people to be fulfilled in their work environment.
Yeah.
So how, as a leader, do you help your employees feel fulfilled?
Right.
You know, you have to be able to identify what they, you know, what they're interested in and provide the tools, give them the tools and the resources to learn and grow. But that, you know, that's what we're starting to do now. But in the past, like you were saying, the whole Henry Ford thing, that was the carrot and stick method.
Right.
A lot of places still do that.
Right.
A lot.
So then let's talk about what you did, though. Now, you as the leader, when you went to the roofing, the manufacturing of roofing. Now it sounds like you came in and you became the thing that started
educator,
to change.
Yeah. Yes. I made sure that all the mechanics, even the operators, I taught them like a reliability basics, like
yep.
course. And I didn't teach them equations or give them these tough definitions. I showed them information that would apply to their job.
Mm-hmm.
I made it simple for them. And the one thing I learned...
Not even simple, applicable, right? You made it applicable for them so that it connected with what they were doing. And immediately they could act on it, it sounds like.
But when you're trying to educate somebody, you don't need to make it complicated. Yeah. Keep it simple.
Right.
And make sure that you also understand who you're giving that information to.
Right.
But I even did like ultrasonic training for the mechanics and the electricians, so that they understand like different predictive methods for identifying issues with our motors or pumps, or even some of the bearings on the rollers that we had. Because
you should describe the machines a little bit. You were talking about the machines are phenomenal. I mean, because you hear roofing, you're like, okay, roofing, you know, talk. But then you stop to think about what it takes to manufacture something like that. And you were describing these, you know, gearboxes that are the size of vans and having to climb inside of them. And
there's so much equipment that's involved. And maintaining, having the proper asset hierarchy, making sure you have all of your bill of materials and your inventory. Mm. You know, what spares do you actually need? Reliability isn't just, I can predict when this is going to fail. It's, I can predict when it's going to fail, but I also have data to support when it's going to fail. Mm. I have inventory and stock to support when it's going to fail because I have the spares that I need because somebody's performed some type of spares model for me. Yep. When it does fail, I can actually write a root cause analysis, do that analysis, or send that equipment to the manufacturer, and hopefully they'll do one for me.
Yeah.
And that's another thing, is getting manufacturers of different equipment to want to do root cause analyses on their equipment, too.
Yeah.
Because that it not only benefits their customer, but it benefits them, because then they can turn around and improve their product, right?
That always surprises me when they resist. I'm like, are you kidding?
Yeah,
like, this is, and then we'll, you know, like I'd be on teams where we even offer to help them too. And I'm like, now you're getting free help to do it. And they still, and it's surprising.
And even like planning and scheduling, making sure that you work closely with the planner and scheduler to get outages scheduled properly and that they're covering, you know, you're covering all of your important work orders that need to get done, your PMs and stuff. And that's actually a funny story. So I had, you know, after working there for almost out a year, I helped the planner schedule our winter shutdown. We had about 2.5 weeks to do, all of our shutdown work.
Yeah.
I created a Gantt chart. I mean, I just did this stuff on Excel because I didn't have anything else to use. Just put it in Excel, got my work order list, all my PMs for both the maintenance team and the production team, gave the work order or the outage list to both, to everybody that was going to be involved. So that included the production supervisor, the maintenance superintendent, the plant manager was involved. I had my mechanic lead and electrician lead. They were both involved in the production lead.
Yeah.
So we had meetings daily in the morning before any work was supposed to be done to do check-ins and everything. But before we even started the shutdown, I got everyone together to go over the list of all the work to be done, just to do an outage outage checklist, basically make sure we had everything covered. And the production supervisor, he looked at this list and he's like, "I don't care about anything that you have on here. We need to get my work done."
Really?
Yes. He screamed at me in front of everybody.
Ugh.
And told me that my stuff, my PMs were not important to him.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's the kind of attitude.
Right. You're just like, what?
That I was fighting against, you know? But,
well, actually, I have a question for you about that, though. The big question is then, I don't know if you did have an opportunity or if other people were aware of it. What was the response or what do you speculate the response would be from the higher ups with regard to that interaction?
Well, since the plant manager was in the meeting.
Okay, so there we go.
He said nothing.
Okay, so there we go.
He was silent. Everyone was silent. And I really had to defend it myself.
That's, yeah.
But I care about it.
Right.
I care. And I care about the health of the equipment.
Right.
And keeping production going so that we all have a job.
Right, right. And
because if we have a motor breakdown because we missed a PM.
Right.
And we didn't detect something using our ultrasound route,
right,
which we spent a lot of money on.
Right.
And we have 12 hours of downtime. That is money lost.
Okay, so can you break down, you think, his perspective for a moment, what his psychology was? Because let's assume also in the end he just as well wants the equipment to be running as much as possible. What do you think is going through his head? Like, what is he thinking? Is it, you know, with regard to PMs, they just take time, they don't really prevent anything? Does he not believe the science? Is it voodoo that you can use ultrasonic equipment and identify what's going on and select what you want to PM? Or what do you think it was?
Well, I actually got to talk to him about his reaction
okay,
afterwards.
Good. You're good. You're good.
And he apologized because he understood why the PMs were important.
Right.
I really think it was just a cultural thing for him. He had come from a plant that, a sister plant that had the mindset of all you got to do is just whatever our checklists are.
Right.
We're not doing reliability stuff. No PMs, just a checklist of cleaning and getting the plant ready to start running again.
Right.
And we got to do it as quickly as possible and get production running as quickly as possible.
So he saw you guys like just some unnecessary checklist. You know, PMs are just something you do to make other people happy.
More downtime.
Right.
We're not going to get started again. Okay. But he didn't see the benefit of doing the PMs ahead of time during the outage where we had scheduled downtime.
But it sounds like he started to turn a little bit. So then what happened next?
Then I got recruited to another company.
Okay, all right. Well, problem solved.
Yeah.
But potentially, I did start
to make headway, and I was kind of breaking down the barriers a little bit with them.
That's I admire that a lot. That's impressive.
It took a long time.
Yeah.
Culture
doesn't.
Yeah, and
so
I was
slow.
One person.
Yeah.
You know, I was just one person, and it took me just having the ambition and the drive to set up the meetings with the appropriate people, you know, with the different teams, making them go through training and saying, "Hey, I believe in this.
Yeah.
I believe they need it.
Yeah.
It will benefit us, and this is why."
Yeah, that's so great.
Sometimes, like nowadays, I think a lot more people are a lot of manufacturing companies are buying into it, but there are a lot out there that aren't.
Yeah.
So I just encourage anyone, if you are passionate about it, stand
as
up
you
for
are.
It. Yeah. But stand up for it. Don't be afraid. And if they don't like it, then that tells you that that's not the place you need to
be
at
anymore. You should go, because you'll end up converting to them if you don't convert them.
Yeah.
You end up, because, you know, the fire will get put out in you, and you'll be like, all right, there's no point. And so it's great.
But even, and just, you know, one more comment about, you know, believing in what you do, being dry, that whole book about the book Drive, you know, needing to be fulfilled.
Yeah.
One of my ambitions, you know, I want to help people. I want to do something that will actually benefit people. Yeah. But if I'm working for an organization that, where their policies are actually hurting people, you know, I should stand up against that.
Right.
And I should speak out against that. And that's part of even the Order of the Engineer. I don't know if y'all, if anybody has heard of that, but I took an oath that I wouldn't do anything or design anything to hurt people.
Yeah.
And that I would take responsibility for those things.
Right.
As an engineer.
Right.
And also, you know, our goal, I think, as engineers is to progress, to improve, is to move forward.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so cool. I feel very fortunate I met you at the conference. I got a chance to talk with you and, you know, about this, and it led to us talking about it in this podcast, because what a unique experience, right? You got to, you know, early in your career, see a really healthy culture, one that really empowers people and really keeps that powerful closed loop. And then you got a chance to dive into the other extreme and then you got to see what can happen when you stand up in there, and you begin to see those changes. And so that's pretty neat. I mean, it's a topic I love talking about. I love talking about, you know, culture and how it affects reliability practices and product development. And yeah, it's really cool. I'm sure we'll be having a lot more conversations about it, but thank you so much for doing the podcast with me. I really appreciate it, Jessica. Yeah, it's great. And please, our listeners, please feel free to leave comments. We always love getting feedback and questions. All right. Thank you again, Jessica.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.